Okay. I'd like to continue a bit on what we mentioned last week, and that is the spilling of the seed, the practice of masturbation, which the Tosafists explain that if one is not commanded in the mitzvah of being fruitful and multiplying, that is, having offspring, procreation, so then this prohibition does not exist as well. And I would just like to, I think there's something that we should explain about this, and that is that in the pagan religions there is a taboo system about certain things, and in certain instances masturbation is one of them. And in halacha, however, we must remember that the halacha does not work with any kind of a taboo system. And everything is based upon the rational commandments of Torah, and we analyze every area, sexual or otherwise, and everything comes under the scrutiny of the mind and the halacha. Halacha is a unique system, not to be found in any other religion, as you're familiar. Over here again, the prohibition against masturbation is based upon the command of procreation. So if there is no command of procreation, then there's no prohibition against masturbation. But there is one thing that I would like to mention in that regard, that in the halacha, we mentioned last week that for the Ben Noach, the command of procreation was removed, and that only existed until the giving of the Torah at Sinai. However, for the Ben Israel, once the institution of Torah came into existence, so then the Ben Israel took up the command, and it became voluntary for the rest of the world. But what I would like to mention is also, I think, you know, there are two things. There is, in halacha, there is the rigid structure of the halacha. Then there is perfection, which goes beyond the halacha, which the halacha can point to. All halacha is perfection, but perfection goes even beyond the halachic system. Not everything that is permitted is perfection. And we've mentioned this a number of times. Now, it's interesting to take a look at the structure of the law with regard to procreation and masturbation, because the Ben Noach is, we mentioned many times, that while there are seven social violations, which if people do not do, they're not worthy of existence, a Ben Noach that's interested in perfection is interested in going beyond that, and that's where all the other commandments and the perfections of the Torah come in. And this is for any human being that wishes to attain perfection. So it's important to understand the structure of the law with regard to the Ben Israel many times, in order to deduce the perfection that a Ben Noach can voluntarily involve himself or herself in. Okay? Now, it's interesting, in the structure of the law with regard to the command of procreation and the auxiliary or accompanying prohibition of masturbation, that once one is under that command, for instance, the Ben Israel, then masturbation becomes prohibited. It becomes prohibited in any instance, okay? Not just in an instance where it would result in a lack of procreation, like in the case of Er and Onan in the Bible, all right, where they spilled their seed. That was coitus interruptus, where they spilled their seed rather than consummate the sexual act. But any kind of act of masturbation, even if it didn't mean the person wasn't involved in procreation, it didn't inhibit his procreation, would still be prohibited. And the question, of course, is why? So here we see that the Torah, when it prohibited the masturbation, it prohibited the entire gamut, which means satisfaction of the sexual instinct through fantasy. So once there was a commandment to procreate, the prohibition wasn't just in terms of an individual act, but rather the whole institution of masturbation was prohibited, which means the institution of being involved in sexual gratification through fantasy, and the act of masturbation became completely prohibited. Now, to my mind, that demonstrates, I believe there's something to be derived from the way the halacha was structured in that area, that it didn't just prohibit for the Ben Israel an act of masturbation which would prevent procreation, but any act at all, at any time, is prohibited. In other words, the entire involvement in that kind of activity became prohibited for the male, Ben Israel, because he is obligated in procreation. I think there's something to be derived from the way that law was structured, okay? It could have been structured two ways. It could have been structured just in the form of onanism, but it wasn't. It was structured across the board. And I believe there's a reason for that, because I believe it indicates a certain perfection in man. In other words, in general, in the eyes of the Torah, the being indulging oneself in the world of fantasy and not reality is really an imperfection. Okay? That's why God wants man to engage himself in the real world. In other words, his satisfactions should be those of the real world and not of the fantasy world. The Torah is very against a human being recoiling from reality and going into the world of fantasy. I believe for that reason, when the prohibition was formulated, it was formulated against the entire institution of masturbation, regardless of whether it actually impedes procreation. The reason is because it is an imperfection on the part of man to engage in the world of sexual fantasy and not in the world of reality which God gave him. So therefore, the reason why I mention this is because I believe from the formula of the prohibition one can learn something, and that is that if a person is seeking perfection, that they would avoid the world of satisfaction via fantasy, because it is God's will that ultimately the perfected man should engage himself in the world that God created for him in reality and not in the world of fantasy. So therefore, while the prohibition there is no prohibition technically in terms of masturbation, if there is no accompanying commandment to procreate, so it is not a technical halachic violation. Nevertheless, a person that is really seeking perfection to the highest degree still wouldn't engage in that practice, because there is a general principle here which is also being shown, and that is that the ultimate human being is to avail himself of God's world, the real world that God created, and to recoil into the world of fantasy is really a human defect. Although it would still not come under a prohibition unless there was a command to procreate. But when there is a command to procreate, then the prohibition is across the board, and the entire institution of fantasy sexualism is of course proscribed, is prohibited. So therefore, what I'm saying is that there is many times when we investigate the structure of the law, from the very structure of the halacha, one can determine what perfection really is, and he who is seeking perfection will guide himself or herself in that direction. So the law serves two purposes. The law serves the purpose of telling us what is strictly considered involving oneself in something which is halachically not proper, and it also delineates and points towards what the highest level of human perfection is. And in this case, of course, it is an important concept, because I think that if a person wants to guide their lives by the ideas of Torah, it's important not just to guide oneself by the halacha alone, but rather by the perfection which the halacha always points to. And even though there is no prohibition in many cases, if a person looks carefully into the halachic system and sees that something which is permissible is still not considered the highest level of human activity, one should always try to guide themselves towards the highest level that is attainable to them. Okay? So therefore, in studying the halacha, we accomplish two things. We find out what the halacha is, the rigid structure, which is of course the essence of the whole system, and then also the way to perfect ourselves and guide ourselves towards the higher level of existence, which is every human being's purpose in life. And as I've mentioned before, Ramban mentions this, and many scholars, the Talmudic scholars mention this. They say that a person should make himself sanctified with that which is permitted to him. Even things that are permitted, a person should sanctify himself by understanding that certain things that a person does, they may be permissible, but they will not raise him or her to a higher level. That's why it's important to understand the halachic structure, so we get not only what the prohibition is, but what the direction is for perfecting ourselves and living the highest kind of existence. I thought it was important to mention that point while we were on this topic. Are there any questions? Okay, if not, then we'll proceed. We'll return to where we left off a while ago in the tractate of Sanhedrin, and that is 56b, okay? And now we're going to 56b, and we're going to study the way the rabbis, the way the scholars of the Talmud derive these seven laws from the Torah itself. Now, you remember that we said that essentially what the scholars of the Talmud were armed with, and we said what the nucleus of the entire system was, what they knew for certain about the seven commandments, which was carried down flawlessly and no one disagreed on. And that was that there are seven prohibitions, the number seven, and there are basically five that everyone agrees on. Two, we'll get to that a little later. There was a disagreement as to what exactly the seven were. We'll get to that a little bit later. But now we're operating with the seven, the basic seven that we're all familiar with, and that's the view of the Talmud that we're taking now. But now the Talmud wants to take it back to the text of the Bible itself, because, as you know, there cannot be any law which does not have its root and does not at least alluded to in the written word of the Torah itself. That is a principle of Torah. Everything in the oral law is always alluded to in some way in the written law itself. And now the Talmud returns to the written law to find where exactly are these seven alluded to. Where do we find in the text itself an allusion to these seven commandments? Okay? And this time we're going to take up one position. Now, I want you to remember as we go through the Talmud that the benefit of Talmud is that we have here the greatest scholars teaching us the sources. But it's not just the sources themselves. But as we go through these sources, we will see different ideas emerge, different concepts, different ideas emerge. That is really more important than the sources themselves, the concepts regarding the sources. And when we're dealing with the seven laws of Noah, we are dealing very closely with philosophical principles. Not just there are areas in the Torah which are simply technical halachic structures. They're also very beautiful, and they are, of course, all related along the line somewhere to a philosophical concept, but sometimes it's a
Rabbi,
long... Yes.
Would you explain philosophical processes? Give a definition of it.
Okay. When I say philosophical processes, I mean philosophical and psychological. In the Torah system, you can't separate the two, because if you're dealing with philosophy, you have to be dealing with human psychology, and it is a rare combination. The Torah does not see philosophy and psychology as two separate subjects, but really as one subject, because the purpose, actually there's no name for the subject of the Torah. If you want to give it a name, it would be perfection. Perfection involves two things. First of all, concepts which teach us the proper way of life. Okay, true concepts, for instance, true ideas about God. What do we mean when we say the word God? What exactly do we have in mind? What do we not have in mind? Okay, those are philosophical ideas. Or when we speak about ethics, and we will get into that a little later today, tonight I hope, what is ethics? In other words, why can't I steal from my neighbor? Is it because I have to be nice to my neighbor? If so, why? What is it based on? Okay, and we're going to discuss a little bit of that. Those are philosophical concepts. Psychological concepts, and we're going to explain those too, is, for instance, we have, as we go on a little further, we'll find a very strange understanding of idolatry, a different aspect of idolatry that no one in the world really has ever concentrated on, because it simply is not in their interests, but Torah does, because the Torah is the is God's system of perfection. And we'll see that there are what the psychological draw of idolatry is, one of the draws. A draw that is a little bit surprising when you look at it. First sight, you don't see it. But there we're dealing with the psychological. Why is man drawn to these things, okay? So the Torah deals with two things. Why man's psyche is drawn to certain things which are not good, and what the good is. What the good is a philosophical question. How man is drawn towards the not good or towards evil is a psychological question. That's what I mean when I say philosophical and psychological. I would say that as a matter of history, the Greeks were very heavy on philosophy, not too heavy, pretty light on psychology. Like a person like Socrates, for instance, came to many conclusions about the way of life that are similar to the ideas of Torah, very very close. Some of the truths that he discovered are exactly the same as the truths of Torah. Maimonides mentions this, and if you study Socrates, you'll find that he actually did come to many many lofty ideas that the Torah espouses. A human being can come to those ideas. Abraham came to those ideas on his own. It requires a very unique person to be able to do that, but a person can come to those conclusions. So the conclusions of the Torah make sense. They're rational. And that's philosophy. But the Torah also, a large part of the Torah, and especially the prophets, is to teach man about himself and why he is drawn towards evil, what component it is in his makeup that draws him towards that, and how he should avoid it. That's why the Torah is more than just a philosophy. It doesn't just tell you what is good, but it tells you in what way you're attracted to that which is not good, and that's the psychological aspect. And the Torah sees these two as fundamental. You can't have one without the other. And we're going to be bouncing off between these two things as we go along. And as we go into these seven commandments, we're going to see different concepts over here in philosophy and also in psychology. Okay? Is there any further? It'll become more clear perhaps as we take examples, and maybe I'll point it out as we go along. What is philosophy and what is psychology? All right? Are there any questions at this point? Okay, then let me continue. Okay, so again, the derivations, the importance of the derivations, and this is the difference between learning Talmud in a scholarly manner and just reading Talmud. When a person just reads Talmud, they think, oh, the rabbis are trying to deduce this, and they're trying to find this from this verse or that verse. It's more than that. It's not just a matter of from which verse. The verses portray ideas. The important thing to learn from the Talmud is the concepts and the ideas that are derived. The verses are nice, and they're important. It's nice to know from which verse we derive what. But that's a technical matter. More important is the concepts and the ideas that we learn that are important in our lives. And if we learn the Talmud properly, we'll see that the ideas open up for us. They really open up these seven laws, what the underlying concepts are. Okay, so let us proceed, and it's a little bit technical. I mean, I can't help it. The Talmud is a science. It's a technical study also, and you have to have a little bit of patience. You don't just get to the ideas right away, but that's part of the process. In any learning process, there always is a tedious part. I mean, no matter what science a person learns, there's always, you have to master certain tedious aspects of the science, and then you get to the heart of it, the beautiful part of it, the ideas. Now, let us take a look over here. We're on 56b, and the Talmud states, where do we know this from? Okay, those are the words of the Talmud. I don't know what your exact translation is, if you have a translation, but in Hebrew it's Minohani Mili. That's an expression which means, from where do we derive this, these seven laws? And the Talmud continues and says, Rabbi Yochanan says it's derived as follows, from this verse. Now, when we say Rabbi Yochanan, it doesn't necessarily mean that he was the first one to come up with this. Many of the things in the Talmud, which are quoted by the, these are Amoraim, they lived in the rather recent, and they don't go back to Sinai, they're in the year of about the 5th century, so you're going back to that time. But the many of these things were actually had sources much earlier, but it means that Rabbi Yochanan, he was of this opinion. You have something similar, and it's important to understand this because, again, it has to do with the basic structure of Talmud. And that is, some people think, for instance, that the Mishnah didn't come about to, well, the 3rd century, they worked out the Mishnah. If you really, anyone that knows the Mishnah, really studies the Mishnah, knows that it's impossible to say the Mishnah just emerged in the 3rd century by Rabbi Judah the Prince. These Mishnahs go way back centuries and centuries, and actually the ideas stem from Sinai. But there was a prohibition against publishing any of the works of the oral law. The oral law was always guarded. I wrote that in one of the gaps, I believe. I explained that there was a prohibition against opening up the oral law for everyone to know. One was not allowed to print, to write the oral law. Rabbi Judah the Prince had to make a decision because he saw it was in danger of being lost, and that's why it was written down at that point. And things weren't written down until the scholars of the generation determined that they might be lost. For instance, the Siddur wasn't written down until about the 9th century. Okay, the reason is because it wasn't felt that it was going to be lost. But then they saw that there are slight variations that are coming about in different places where they're praying, and they were afraid that these slight variations may be okay, but then it's liable to lead to greater variations and mistakes and errors. So then it was decided that there should be an official Siddur written in order to ensure that there is no deviation. But of course at a sacrifice, because once you make things public, there is always the danger, and that's why there was always a prohibition against writing down the oral law. Because an unscrupulous person or an ignorant person can gain access to it, and not knowing the true method of understanding it, will present himself as an authority and fool masses of people and say, look, I got the same things as these rabbis are telling you, and I'm telling you that it says right here that you can desecrate the Sabbath. And these statements have been made. There's a statement, for instance, in Talmud that says, Rabbi Akiva says, that it's better to make your Sabbath as a weekday than to go beg for food. So taken in a literal way, a person say, well, Rabbi Akiva suggested working on the Sabbath. Of course, Rabbi Akiva meant not to eat food any differently on the Sabbath. He was referring to the Sabbath meal. But a person who's not a scholar can take things out of context and can fool people into, once he has access to the oral law, he could claim to be an expert when he's not. And that's why the oral law was always guarded, but it was always written down by the scholars themselves. However, it wasn't made public till the scholars determined that there is a danger of loss, so we have to weigh the danger of loss against the danger of misrepresentation. And this is it's an important principle to remember as you study the Talmud. So when you have a statement from a rabbi, it doesn't necessarily mean that that's the first time that this statement was ever made. It means that is his conviction. Of all the statements that he's gone through the ages, there were certain things that were carried down. This is his conviction. It would be similar to Euclid. Euclid wrote Geometry, three volumes on geometry. And his books, of course, his books on geometry, if a person just looks at them, well, he was the first one that that made all these discoveries in geometry. Phenomenal genius. It's not true. These discoveries in geometry were made for many, many years, decades, and actually centuries before Euclid. But what Euclid did was he took them all and he just organized them in a very beautiful, logical way. And he entitled it Euclid's Elements, and this was Euclid's geometry, Euclidean geometry. We still call it Euclidean geometry. But he wasn't the one that made it up. He simply took all the knowledge from before, and he organized it and put it into a form of a book. It's very similar over here also when you have the statements of the rabbis. Many statements predate the author of the statement. The author is merely saying that this is his view. So when he says that this is so, it doesn't mean he originated the thought, necessarily. Sometimes, yes, but not always, not even most of the time. Many times it's simply a statement that he endorses. He's telling you this is the proper view. And it's mentioned, he's mentioned as the author of the statement. Doesn't mean he's the first one that thought of it. Okay, that's important just to know these basic principles of how the Talmud works. So now we have the statement from Rabbi Yochanan. And Rabbi Yochanan says, here is where the derivation of the seven laws are from. Now, I will read you the verse, and we will, first you probably will be shocked that this is the verse, but as we go along, you'll see that what the Talmud means in terms of the derivation, and then we'll go into the concepts. The verse is Genesis 2, and it is verse 16. The verse states as follows, And God Almighty commanded on the man, or to the man, saying, from all the trees of the garden you shall eat. But it says double language. Eat, you shall eat. Okay? Eating is the, puts the infinitive first. Infinitive eating, you shall eat. Okay. Now the Talmud says, Rabbi Yochanan says that this is the source for the derivation of the seven laws. Okay. Now, I believe last year at the conference I spoke about this, and I mentioned that this verse is the first verse that introduces the in this account. There are two accounts of the creation of man. There's a reason for that. I went through that. But the second account, the first time that it is indicated that man is really a creature who has a divine element is this verse. Okay? In the first account, it states openly that he was created in the divine image. But in the second account, until this point, it does not really mention anywhere about the fact that he had a divine element. It does say that God created him, and especially with a special creation for man, and that's one of the principles of Torah, that man is not simply the essence of man. His mind did not come about through an evolutionary process, but this was a special gift from God, and that's in verse 7. But nevertheless, it doesn't mention openly that what kind of a being he was, what kind of a level of existence he was. Until this verse, it becomes clear, because it states that God commanded the man, saying. Now, commanded means that you must have a being that is capable of receiving commandments, understanding commandments, an intellectual creature, and also a creature who has free will, because you don't give a command to a creature that doesn't have the free will to either do or not do the command, okay? Unless we call it a command, if you give a command to a dog, for instance, but that's just training, that's not a real command. But command to a human being means you're instructing him that this is the good for him, but he has the ability to either refrain or to comply. It's up to him. So this verse is a very important verse. It is the single verse that shows that man was unique, different than all the other creation. He had intelligence. He understood the commandment. He had knowledge. To understand God's commandment requires knowledge. And he had the ability, the free will, to choose whether he would obey or not obey the command. So the human being emerges from this verse. And that's why Rabbi Yochanan says, this is the verse to look into, and in this verse we will be able to find an allusion to these seven laws. Okay? Now, let us take a look at the verse, okay? Now, this is the way this is the way it works. It's a little bit different. You might not be used to this kind. Okay. Now, if you take a look at this verse, I haven't checked it in English, but in Hebrew, it comes out that this verse breaks up into seven components, okay? And that is seven, in other words, the verse itself can be broken up into, it breaks up naturally into seven components. And we will see that every one of these components happens to contain, in a logical way, a reference to the seven commandments. All right? Now, when I said, and let me just clarify this, because you're not used to the style. But the way the Torah is written, this is part of the oral law. The Torah is written in a way that it's God's infinite wisdom, and there are, you may have heard, codes of the Torah. So there is infinite wisdom in God's Torah. So the Torah is written on different levels. There's a plain reading, okay? But then it's also written with an eye for the deeper understanding. And that I think you're familiar with. If you analyze the text, many times you see dialogues don't make sense. You take a look, you look a little deeper, you'll see a deep concept there, and everything fits in very smoothly. There are several methods, though, however, that we have from Sinai of analyzing the Torah. One of the things, of course, one that is most often used is the fact that the extra words. There are no extra words in the Torah, but there is a method of reference. Now, the method of reference is if you have a word, and then there is this word is mentioned in another place, and the meaning is found in the second place. It's expanded upon, then the first place also is a reference to that. In other words, it's like an equation. Like you say, a word over here and a word in another place, whatever the word in the other place means in the expanded version is also a reference, also means the same thing in this verse. Okay? So we learn by way of reference. In other words, like extrapolation. You extrapolate from one area to another area. Now, over here, in this case, what the Talmud is saying, and the Talmud, there's an argument about this. Not everyone accepted this. the Talmud is a search for God's knowledge, and it has to be rational, it has to make sense. Rabbi Yochanan says, this position in the Talmud is, that it is an amazing fact that this verse, which has to do with the essence of man, the first time where the Torah explains to us, in the second account, what man's essence is, that this verse happens to break down naturally into seven components. Okay? That strikes one as a sign that there may be something more here. Let's check into this. Okay? That's like a little light over here. Now, when the Talmud does check into it, it discovers, amazingly, that every one of these words, without going too far off course, can be seen as a reference to one of the seven laws. And we're going to go into these into these words, and we'll show exactly how it works. Now, as I told you, one of the methods of the Torah is to the cross-referencing. All right. Now, through cross-referencing, and also through an understanding of the word itself in its primary, in its most primary sense, we'll see that there's an amazing thing about this verse. It happens to break down into seven components, and those seven components happen to be the seven laws. All right. Now, don't expect to find since this is the method of reference. So the method of reference is not overt, but then again, it's not completely wild either. There is something to it. In other words, when we look at it, we'll see that it is an amazing thing that it just happens to break down to these seven words, and these seven words are allusions, without going too far, of course, to the seven laws. Okay. So if we've got that much, we're going to proceed. Okay. Now, the first word is, in Hebrew, is Vayetzav, and he commanded. You understand? When you read the translation, you're not going to have the same order as you do have in the Hebrew. The translation says, and God, and then it uses the word Elohim. Of course, I say Elohim. The last syllable is him, but I always say Kim because I don't want to pronounce God's name. So the so just remember that. Now, the first word, if you read it in English, it'll say, and God Almighty commanded. That's because in English, the subject comes first. But in Hebrew, it doesn't work that way. In Hebrew, the first word is, and he commanded. then comes the subject, okay? And you drop the pronoun when the subject follows, all right? It's a little complicated, but not that impossible to understand. So now let's take each word. The first word is basically the element of commanded, okay? So the Talmud says the word commanded implies what? What does the word commanded imply? It implies commandments, keeping of commandments, and a system of commandments. And this we find a cross-reference in Genesis 18, where God says about Abraham, because I know him, in order that he should command his sons and his children after him, his household after him. Now, this word command, you see, is not just used as a single command, but rather it's saying that Abraham will command his sons, his family, his household after him to keep the way of God, which means to say the whole system of God, God's whole system, will be kept by Abraham. So it's speaking about keeping the entire system. In other words, God is saying about Abraham, because I know Abraham, he is a type of person, that he will keep my system for himself and for his family afterwards, and they will keep the way of God to do justice and righteousness. In other words, he's a guardian of the system. So the word command over there means not just a single commandment, but it means keeping the entire system of commandments. All right? We have the same exact word over there. Now, over there, the word means being a guardian of the system. So the Talmud says, so we have a right to say that the word over here, not in its primary sense, not in its plain sense, but in its reference sense, is also referring to the concept of guarding the commandments. Not just keeping a commandment, but guarding a system of commandments. And that is one of the laws of the B'nai Noach, which is to not just to keep the individual commandments, but to guard the entire system. Okay, just like Abraham kept the entire system. So we see by cross-referencing that the word command doesn't only mean to keep a single command, but it means to keep the whole system of commandments. So therefore, we can say, by way of reference, that this first word by itself, command, means keeping the system of commandments, which means the seventh law for the Ben Noach to make sure that God's commandments, the system, is kept. Okay? That's one. Two. The second word in that verse is God. Okay, now this word, this God, two references to God. One is Ad Hashem, and that is the tetragrammaton, four-letter word. That's the first reference to God. The second reference to God is Elohim, which means Almighty. But let's take the first one. Now you see there's a double reference to God in this verse. Now the first reference is the name of God, which is the highest name that we have in reference to God in the Torah. Now the Talmud says again that this name is referring to the violation, the prohibition against profaning God's name, blasphemy, which we studied at length on the tapes last year. And we remember that primarily, that in order to violate that law, one must use that name of God. So we see that the name of God and keeping the name of God holy means refraining from blasphemy with regard to that name. So there again you have the name. There is one of the seven laws of Noah has to do with the name and with this name, okay? And this name in specific. So there you have a reference to the second law. Then you have the third word is Elohim. Elohim means God in the sense that God is almighty, all right? All powerful, multi powerful. That's why it's pluralized. Christians always try to read into the pluralization. But the pluralization is not a reference, of course, to pluralization, heaven forbid, with regard to the Creator. But it means multi-powerful. That's why it's in the plural. And that name is used not only for God, but the name is used also for a prince or someone who is in a high position of power. But when we mention it ordinarily, and in this verse, of course, it's in reference to God. But the Talmud says that if we use the system of cross-reference, we find that that word is also mentioned in the Ten Commandments, where it says, "You shall not have before me," and there it uses the word Elohim again, but it says Elohim Acherim, which means, and this has to be very carefully translated, most people translate, "Thou shalt not have any other gods before me." Now, that is a dangerous statement, because there are no other gods. As a matter of fact, I mean, you're studying Isaiah, I know, and Isaiah 37:19 says, "And he will put their gods in fire, because they are not gods, but they are only the handiwork of man. They are wood and stone." Okay, so there are no other gods. All right, there's only one God. Now, the reason why the Rashi's translation, there are several interpretations to that phrase, but the simplest one actually is Rashi. Rashi says that in Hebrew there is such a thing called smichus, which means if you have two words together, there's an of that's understood there, and that is found many times in the Torah. That's a rule in the Hebrew grammar. So Rashi says the proper translation is not other gods, but gods of others. All right, that's what it means. Elohim shel acherim. Yes, the of is understood, but when the two words are close together, they're referenced to possessive. So it means the gods of others. But at any rate, getting back to this piece of Talmud here. So the Talmud says, now that word Elohim means that there is only one Almighty, and a person should not, because when you speak about the gods of others, you're saying that thing which others consider as Almighty. Now, you couldn't use the first name of God, because that is a reference to the real God. But the second term, which implies simply that God is all-powerful, multi-powerful, so there, that term can be used with reference to idols or stars or other forces, insofar as other people claim or believe that these things are all-powerful. Okay? So, therefore, the Talmud says that second name of God is there because it has a double reference. It means He, the true God, is the one that should be your Almighty, and not, you should not make Almighty the gods of others. All right? And the same word, Elohim, is used in relationship to God, and it's also used in relationship to the false gods or the gods of others. So therefore, the Talmud says that it is not too difficult, if we're looking for reference, by way of reference, to see how this word over here is a reference to the violation of idolatry. Because it means the one that in your mind should be all-powerful is the true God, and you should not ascribe any type of power to any other forces. Okay? So that's the third element in the verse. Now we continue. It says, Al Ha'adam, okay, which means on, God commanded on the man. Now here, many times, the way we derive something is that there is something a little bit off, a little awry in the verse. It's not smooth. Whenever the Torah is not smooth, it means it wants to give you another idea, a side idea, as it's talking. So it changes something which makes it a little rough, but if you look into it, you'll see that the reason why it's rough is because it's trying to teach you something else also. It's trying to teach you two things at once. And the Talmud uses that method over here, because it says that God Almighty commanded, and it says, on the man. It doesn't say to the man, but it says on the man. Okay? Now, on the man could be translated also as about or concerning the man. All right? So, therefore, the Talmud says that, not in the literal sense, but in the reference method, we see the Torah went out of its way to change something, to make it unsmooth, and it says, God commanded about the man. Now, what is there to command about the man? Okay? So the Talmud says, there is the most essential thing, if you're going to give a commandment to a human being about man, the most essential commandment you give him is not to kill man, not to destroy man. And that's why it quotes the verse later on in Genesis, where it says, he who spills the blood of the man shall his own blood be spilt. Okay? So the Torah is, by going a little bit off course and saying that God commanded about the man, well, what is the most major commandment that you can give man about his fellow man? Well, the most major thing you can do is, most primary thing you can do is command him not to destroy the other man. Okay? So, again, if you take that component of the verse, there is, without, by way of reference, there is a clear connection between that word and the commandment, which is a prohibition against murder of man. Okay, now the next one we have, the next word there is lamor. Lamor is saying. Now this one is not as easy as the other ones. The other ones go along pretty smoothly. This one is a little difficult, because here the Talmud makes a very strange cross-reference. The cross-reference it gives is Jeremiah 3. Alright? Now Jeremiah 3 is a very strange cross-reference, because you could give cross-references about the five books of Moses within the five books of Moses. That's legitimate, because those are all one entity given by God to Moses at Sinai, and they're all one unit. So the system is made to cross-reference from any one place to another place. That's the way it was built. That's the way God constructed the Torah. That's the hidden aspects of the Torah, the code system of the Torah. But of course, Jeremiah was not given, as we understand it, at Sinai. So the question is, how could the Talmud possibly use a cross-reference to Jeremiah? That would seem to be not a legitimate method, okay? But we'll see that if we understand the concept, we'll see how this works. And we'll see it's not precisely a cross-reference. Now, what the Talmud is saying is as follows. Let me give the verse first. The verse is Jeremiah 3:1. I didn't look at any English translations. I don't know exactly how to translate. But in Hebrew, it says, you have the word lamor. Now, lamor usually is something which follows a verse. In other words, and God spoke to Moses lamor. He spoke to him saying. All right? You don't start off a verse with lamor. It's not done. Okay. However, here is one time where it is done. And it's strange. But what it's talking about here in Jeremiah is that God is saying to the people that a man will send away his wife, and she'll leave him, and she'll live with another man. Will he ever go back to her? He won't, because he will feel that this woman has been disloyal to him. And God says, and you, the Jewish people, you have strayed from me. You have prostituted yourselves to others. But, nevertheless, I say to you, return to me. Okay? So, here, it's talking about, this is, of course, a parable found throughout the prophets, that when Israel strays, they're considered as if they are the disloyal wife of the Creator of God. All right? Now, the reason is, why, just let me give you why you have that analogy. The analogy is very simple, because in the marriage bond, if one is disloyal, what does this mean? This means usually that the person that is being disloyal recognizes that it's not, speaking where the marriage is good, the partners are good to each other, and if one of them strays, in this case the woman strays, it means to say that she is making a mistake. Her mind would tell her not to do this. It's not just, it's not right. But she's caught up by the temptation of the moment and gives way to her emotions rather than to her judgment. That is that is the parable. Now, therefore, whenever the Torah says that Israel strayed from God, it gives that analogy, because that's a perfect analogy. It means that Israel recognizes, or they should recognize at least, that God's path is the right path. Their mind should tell them this is right. But they're suddenly lured by the momentary attractions of the physical or the idolatrous, some attraction there that captivates them, and they follow the captivating emotion rather than what their mind tells them to be correct. So that's why that analogy is always used. Now, over here, Jeremiah is using that same analogy. All right, so he's using the analogy of the woman that strays away from her good husband, and she strays because she's lured momentarily by desire, all right, by emotion rather than her mind, rather than following her mind. And Jeremiah introduces this whole little parable with that word lamor. Now, it's very strange because, as I said, lamor usually is the last word in the sentence, not the first, okay? So the question is, why did Jeremiah himself made this little change, this little rough spot in formulating his speech over here? And the Talmud is saying as follows, that Jeremiah is teaching you also parenthetically a concept, an idea of Torah, and that is that in man, when man strays, when a person is involved in illicit sexual activity, it's not, as most people think, just because of physical desire. It really is because of a lure of the mind and a luring of the, I don't mean the mind in terms of intellect, I mean in terms of fantasy, and this is always expressed in speech in a human being. Speech is the vehicle through which man expresses his desires and his instincts. And what Jeremiah is teaching here by putting that word in the beginning is that through speech, the instinctual part of man always takes form. It's not simply like an animal has physical desire. Man doesn't have raw physical desire. Man's desire is subtle. And the desire comes about through speech as the main component of an illicit affair. Illicit affair is speech. 99.9% of the affair is speaking. The act is only a very short moment, but the speaking, the instinctual talk, and the speech that is involved in the affair is really the essence in man. This is found really in the Torah in several places. You have by the case of Shechem, if you remember, when he fell in love with Dina. So there the Bible says, and he spoke upon the heart of the young girl. Okay? So, again, he spoke. Speech is used as the seduction of speech. But I think the most glaring example really is in Proverbs 7. And it's a beautiful, Proverbs 7 is really something beautiful, something everybody should read. I think it's one of the most beautiful parables on description of how man follows his emotions and not his senses. And it gives the description of a person that's lured by the evil woman. The evil woman really is referring to as an example of the prostitute here, as an example of the emotions of man, how they lure him and fool him. But the description is interesting because it says, King Solomon says, describes how he's looking out of his window and he sees a young person that doesn't have any knowledge or understanding, and he's watching him being lured by these desires, and he knows exactly what's going to happen to him, but the person that's being lured doesn't recognize this at all. They think they're going for something good, and then they finally, when it's too late, they realize that they lost their life. So he gives this beautiful description here. And then when he has, it's interesting, but when he has the prostitute finally meets this young, ignorant person, first it shows how he goes around the corner, which means to say that he really is going there for a reason. It's not an accident. He's looking for something. And then when she grabs him and she kisses him, But then the verse 14 and 15 and 16 and 17 and 18, 19 is all those verses, so many verses, tell you what she says to him, the speech, the way she speaks to him. She tries to show him she's fine, she's paid her obligations, and then she lures him, and the whole approach is actually a description of how the fantasy of man just lures him, and but it's all speech. The example's all given in speech, and then he sums it up, and he says in verse 21, he says, "With her much fair speech, she causes him to yield. With the smoothness of her lips, she seduces him." So you see, from this, from Proverbs, the concept in the Torah that really it is the speech of man that is mainly involved in the seductive process. And that's why in the Talmud you have so many prohibitions against speech, certain types of speech, which the Talmud says that if one engages in that kind of speech, it leads to a process where the instinctual is awakened, and if the person follows those emotions, then they could actually destroy themselves spiritually. So seduction and speech are really, a certain type of speech are synonymous. Now, what the Talmud is saying is like this, that word lamar means to say, to speak. And the Talmud says that Jeremiah purposely introduces his parable with that word in a strange way in order to reflect that concept, that same word lamar. The word reflects the idea that the seductive process in man is not simply physical, but it really is one of talking and speaking, which is the main medium of involving oneself in the seductive process. So, therefore, the Talmud says that the word lamar over here, saying, can also be understood as the seductive speech, which plays a big role in Torah and in the prophets. Okay? So it's not too far-fetched to use that word to indicate the violation against illicit sexual affairs. Okay. Then the Talmud continues, and it says that we did already, I believe, four references, correct? Five. We have five ready. And now we come to where it says, from all the trees of the garden, all right? And the Talmud says...